Committee on Environment and Natural Resources will come to order. There are a couple of more lengthier bills on the agenda, and I don't know if Senator Olson is here, but I think for Senator Olson's bill, I informed folks, that at least the proponents, that we're going to have a half an hour devoted to the testimony to that bill. So proponents, 15 minutes, opponents, 15 minutes, and you can manage those 15 minutes any way you like. If you want 10 people to speak for 1.5 minutes or one person to speak for 15 minutes, that's up to you. The same is going to be true for the Sparks bill. Those in favor of the Sparks bill, 15 minutes. Those opposed, 15 minutes. I know there are some folks who want to testify on this who are here, so I just want folks to be aware that unless we keep some kind of some time structure here, we won't be able to get to all the other bills. So why don't we start with Senator Scogin's bill? This is relatively easy to cover. Senate File 1318. And then hopefully Senator Fredrickson will be here and we can take his bill up next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. Senate File 1318 will deal with an exemption for military personnel in regards to gun training. And I would like to put it in order by offering the A1 delete all. Oh, we already did that part?
Senators.
I'm sorry.
That was the last committee.
Senator, I still had it in my file.
Oh, okay. Okay.
It's already in your
hey, we're lacking a quorum anyway, but we have the. Do we have the engrossment?
Yes.
Okay. We have the engrossed version, Senator Scogin. Go ahead.
You will. I think the line that I'd like to point out is that on line 1.6. Well, let me look at yours. You seem to have a updated
sorry
version.
It's Monday.
1.10 exempt from the range and shooting exercise portion of the required course of instruction for the firearm safety certificate. That's the part that we would like to see the military personnel exempt from. These are young men and women that are coming back from the military. They've handled weapons. They've had training with weapons. And we just didn't see the need for them to go out on the course. That does not mean that they are exempt from the other requirements in the firearm safety certificate training. They still need to talk about hunter ethics, hunter safety, the different things that are covered. And with me today is Bob Meyer.
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. The bill, Senate File 1318, first engrossment, represents a compromise that was worked out between the Firearm Safety Instructors Association, the DNR, and the authors of the bill. In the Senate or in the House, the bill, as was introduced, would completely exempt veterans and peace officers from the requirements of firearm safety, which would have jeopardized our certification program through the International Hunter Education Association and our reciprocity throughout the rest of the state of the United States. What we've come up with is they will still have to take the online program or go through a class. The online program, IHEA, is similar to what we have in the book. And if people are interested, I can pass this around, or I'll have it later on if you want to see a copy of it, that you go through in the actual class. It's about 16 hours of classroom training, or it takes about 4 to 5 hours on the web. You then, if you do an independent study, you need to contact a certified firearms instructor, meet up, take the same test that you do in the class, achieve a 75% or better score, and there still are some safety days or some safety training on the field, crossing fences, tree stands, things of that nature. You're still required to do the they call them ethical dilemmas worksheet, where there's a series of 5 questions. You have to answer 3, and in a short essay answer those questions. The instructors review those. You take the test. What this will do is exempt those veterans from taking the 15-round mandatory shooting. So, and I am a certified firearms instructor. What I do, they contact me. I meet them at the gun club. We go through their homework. I issue them the test, and then I have a 22. We go down to the range. They have to shoot 15 rounds. Doesn't matter if they hit the target or anything. Of course, we encourage them to hit the target. But the requirement in statute is just that they fire 15 rounds. This just exempts those veterans from that 15-round shooting exercise. They still have to do everything else exactly the same as anybody.
Just, Mr. Meyer, when you say that you arrange a time for them to come to the gun club, is this not... Do you do it on an individual basis? So these aren't groups that are coming in that have scheduled a time or are coming to a time you've preset to do these? An individual calls you one-on-one and does this?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, on the DNR safety training website, there is a list of certified firearms instructors by county that people can call and have that one-on-one exercise taken during times that are mutually agreeable to those people for the internet portion of the online training. Some people like to do it. Say I do it every third Saturday of the month. Some people have organized times. I try to do it what works. My goal is to make sure we get as many people safely into the woods as possible. So I try to work around their calendar as well. I believe last year I certified about 20 people, just individuals. At different times, it got to the point in later in the season where I had to group them together just because otherwise I'd be doing it every night. So different instructors do it different ways.
Okay. And the time that you arrange, it's more than just for shooting. It's to do other things as well?
Mr. Chair, members, yes. I typically bring out a couple different kinds of tree stands, maybe show them a couple different kinds of guns, a muzzle loader, a bolt action. Kind of base it on their experience. A lot of these people have been hunting for a long time. They need the certification because they're either going to another state or when the law was changed about 3 years ago, you just had to have a license that you bought in a previous year. So even though the law states you have to, if you're born after December 31st, 1979, there were some people who obtained a hunting license without firearm certification that met that age qualification, and they were caught in this loophole, which really it brought me to be an instructor because I had a big hand in changing that loophole, tightening that loophole down, so the people who were stayed caught up in that, I wanted to make sure they were able to get in the field as soon as possible. So it is one-on-one, kind of customized to the person's experiences, but fence crossing, safe handling of firearms, tree stand safety are the three things that people stress for sure in each one-on-one exercise.
Senator Vickerman.
Well, Mr. Chair, we're talking about veterans and not just everybody strictly for veterans. Am I reading this right? Sure. Yep. So you're not going to have other people in that.
That's correct, Senator Vickerman. This bill just pertains to veterans, a person who has successfully completed basic training in the armed forces.
Mr. Chair,
correct?
Yes, on that point, the language that we did amend in Senator Vickerman's committee also expanded this exemption to peace officers as well. The Firearm Safety Instructors Association is concerned about that. I mean, the issue that we're trying to deal with is veterans. We'd like to keep it tight to veterans and not expand it to peace officers just because I don't think there's a problem with that. Those people at all. I've never heard from a peace officer who needed to have the firearms training certification at all. So what we're trying to solve here is with the 2,500 men and women coming back here shortly from overseas, Iraq, we want to make sure that they can get in the woods very quickly. The Game of Fish Bill has an apprentice program that will allow a one-year window for a person to get to go out hunting with someone who is certified in firearm safety, and there's some other parameters there, but this also is a way to make sure that these folks can enjoy our hunting season, hopefully this fall.
But you said that they're already going to have to come out and meet you for this other stuff.
Mr. Chair, correct. The concern that came about from the testifier in the House was that he thought of it as kind of a insult or a put down that he had to then take the training and then have to shoot a 22 15 times when he's been handling a lot of different military weapons for quite a long time, defending our country and protecting people's lives. And then I have to come over here and I hand him a little Ruger 22. I say, okay, now you got to shoot it 15 times. You're like, that's where the concern, I think, comes from, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Chair, at the same time, we wanted to keep hold of people who for years have done the gun training and understand the importance of the gun ethical training as well, hunter ethics.
Doesn't that same principle apply to the police?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, it could. The concern that was addressed specifically in this bill was just for veterans. So I understand your point, but I just wanted to raise that as well.
I think Senator Ingebrigtsen brought up a point in the Veterans Committee that this could just as easily apply to concealed carry permit holders as well, because they are already required to go through a training. Isn't that true, Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did say that at the meeting. There is, however, one other requirement, I believe, with the Personal Protection Act, and that is a legal part of that act. There's a certain amount of instruction of the legalities of carrying that gun that wouldn't be covered here. So I was partially right that day, I guess. So. Thanks.
But they are required to shoot a gun
as
part of that training.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
This could be a... This 15-round requirement could be an insult to them as well.
You could say that. They're required to shoot an awful lot every year.
Okay. Did you have anything else, Senator Scogin?
Mr. Chair, no.
Witnesses? Any other discussion from the committee? Senate File 1318 will be laid over for possible consideration in inclusion in the omnibus policy bill.
Thank you. Thank you, committee.
Senator Fredrickson, Senate File 739.
So there's a difference.
Senate File 739.
Mr. Chairman, members, Senate File 739 deals with Class 2 all-terrain vehicles, and Class 2 all-terrain vehicles are the larger all-terrain vehicles that can weigh up to 1,600 pounds. They're significantly different ATV, I believe, than the Class 1. And, Mr. Chairman, I do have an amendment I'd like to offer. This is the first committee it's before, and it's the A2 amendment. Mr. Chairman, this is the first committee this is before, but I will tell you the amendment makes a couple technical changes, another small change, and the most significant thing is that these Class 2 ATVs would be allowed to be driven on the right-hand side of the roads, and this removes that authority to drive them on the right-hand side of the road from trunk highways.
Author's amendment on the A2. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I have Mr. Myers here with me from the Department of Natural Resources, and I think we'll go through it together, and I'll let Mr. Myers lead the committee through the bill.
Go ahead, Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you once again. Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. The bill before you today is really a technical bill, cleaning up some provisions that were passed late last session in the last bill of the session that the House passed, and then the Senate took up before you did your omnibus bill on that Sunday night. There were some technical changes that needed to be done to the Class 2 language, but due to the situation at hand and the House file coming over, unable to amend it, working with Senator Marty, I promised him that we would come back and clean this up this session. So the bill before you today is something we worked with Senator Marty's office, Greg Knopf's office, or Mr. Knopf, I should say, and other people, MnDOT. We discussed the issue with Association of Minnesota Counties as well and the stakeholder groups to come up with this language. Section 1 really just clarifies when helmets and seat belts are needed. Currently in statute, it was quite confusing, so we just wanted to clarify that says a person less than 18 years of age shall not ride as a passenger or as an operator of an all-terrain vehicle on public lands. And then you'll see B, the new language, a person less than 18 years of age shall not ride as a passenger or as an operator of a Class 2 ATV without wearing the safety belt provided by a manufacturer.
Mr. Chairman, these Class 2 ATVs, typically the passenger and the driver sit side by side, and they're equipped with seat belts. And I think it's very important that they wear seat belts, that they're under. I think everybody should wear a seat belt when operating these, but particularly those who are under age 18. My son has one of these on his farm, and I drive it occasionally, and occasionally I take grandchildren on rides, and I cannot imagine riding one of these without buckling the seatbelt. So that's what this is all about. It's a safety issue.
Is one of those John Deere Gators, is that a Class 2?
Mr. Chairman, yes,
all-terrain vehicle?
Yes, it is. And there are others. Polaris makes them also. And they're very handy vehicles. They're utilitarian. And around a farm, they're practically like a small tractor.
Yeah. Well, I mean...
So, Mr. Chairman, Polaris Ranger.
She happens to own one.
Yes, and I agree that once you have one, you can't get along without it.
Yeah, they're fun. Oh,
well it's they're useful.
And it's fun for the grandkids to drive around the farm on, and maybe they should be
have
a helmet on.
We have enough of those on
least.
Our farm already.
Mr. Chairman, it is. So.
Yeah. But on Subdivision 2, aren't you prohibiting people under 18 from operating any ATV on public land? Isn't that what that's doing?
Mr. Chairman, on line 13, it says a Class 2 all-terrain.
But I'm looking at...
Section 2. Mr. Chairman, are you looking at Subdivision 2 or Section 2?
Subdivision 2, 1.9... Excuse me, Section 1, Subdivision 2, line 1.9, passenger or as an operator.
Mr. Chair, members, that deals with helmets and seat belts. So you have to have a helmet on or...
unless wearing a... Okay.
Unless it has seat belts as well.
Okay. All right.
The provisions in Section 1 and Section 2 of the bill already exist in statute. What we're trying to do is clarify that they do apply to Class 1 and Class 2 ATVs, and make it simpler for the reader of the laws and for when we publish these statutes, for people to understand when and when not, when you have to and when you don't have to wear helmets or safety belts. So Section 1 just clarifies the helmets and safety belt issue. Section 2 really clarifies the parent or guardian authorization. You'll see there a person shall not, under age 16, shall not operate, and a person shall not allow operation under age 16. Unless a parent or guardian of the person under age 16 authorizes the operation. And then this is where the first of Senator Frederickson's amendment comes in. It'll read now, for the purposes of this subdivision, guardian means a legal guardian of the person under age 16 or a person age 18 or older who has been authorized by the parent or legal guardian to supervise the person under 16. So... I'm sorry, Mr.
Chairman. So you got
to have. We made a technical amendment to the language. We made it read a little clearer there.
Oh, okay.
So you got to be. All that deletion did not make it.
If you're under 16, you need permission from a parent or guardian, and a guardian includes someone who's 18 who's been designated by a parent or guardian.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
All right.
Mr. Chair, members, moving on to Section 3. Again, this is a technical change, just clarifying passengers, the number of passengers on there. As we put these statutes together, they were kind of laid on top of each other, so we wanted to clarify this as well, just kind of make it as simple as possible, where it states now a person 18 years of age or older may operate a Class 1 ATV, or it should say may operate a Class 1 ATV while carrying one passenger, and a person 18 years of age or older may operate a Class 2 ATV while carrying up to the number of passengers the vehicle was designed for, whichever is greater. Some of these have two. Some of them are made for three people. Some of them may have jump seats in the back where there's safety belts and a roll bar, so they're made for four people. You know how much they're what they've been designed for. So we want to make sure, rather than just allowing two or three, we go for what we put in statute, what they're designed to carry. And then you'll see in Section 4 of the bill, this deals with some trail language here. It just says, except as provided in Subdivision 4, we're in 84.926. Now, operation of a Class 2 ATV on DNR lands, or lands administered by the commissioner, is limited to forest roads, minimum maintenance roads, and trails designed for or signed for Class 2 ATVs. These will typically be your railroad, abandoned railroad grades. The Soo Line Trail, for example, is a classic example. These are bigger, they are heavier than our Class 1 ATV trail system is designed for. We don't want them in the woods, per se, on an ATV trail system because they're narrower. The regular Class 1s are a smaller machine. These are a lot wider. They aren't designed to be in, or I should say our ATV Class 1 trail system is not designed for these Class 2 ATVs, but we are going to be looking to put opportunities in, and they will be primarily abandoned railroad grades and things like that. Where there's a road surface that will be able to withstand the use of these machines.
I want to be a little careful about that, Mr. Meyer. I'm not disagreeing with what you have here. I think it's correct. But I think one of the important things to note about trails and designating the proper trail and the grade and the sustainability of the trail is how many pounds per square inch a particular thing puts onto that trail. And whether it be a ATV or a horse or a Class 2 ATV or a mountain bike. And so I don't want us to leave with the impression that Class 2s are necessarily bad. Some of them are very big and have a lot of pounds per square inch. You know, there's the Gators, the larger versions of the Rangers. But then there's also smaller Class 2s as well that are just barely over that 900-pound definition. So I just want to make sure that's clear. There's nuances here. Class 2, just because it's side-by-side doesn't mean it's necessarily bad for being in the woods.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for clarifying that point. This just goes along with what we're doing right now, managed use on managed trails. We want to make sure that these machines are able to be ridden where they can be. So this allows us to make sure that we do that.
Correct.
Section 5 of the bill is really where the clarification takes place. What had happened when the bill was passed last session, it allowed for these machines to be ridden on public road right-of-ways, but it did not provide for a public road authority to restrict their uses. So, in essence, what had happened is across the board there was use of these machines in the public road right-of-ways, which would have included controlled access freeways, technically. The Commissioner of Department of Transportation has issued an executive order prohibiting the use of these machines on controlled access freeways. And the bill did not go into effect until December 12th of last year due to our ELS licensing and things like that. So they've been operating in this gray area for several months now, which is one of the reasons to have this language passed. But what we're trying to do here, you'll say we've separated in this section Class 1s and Class 2s. So the 2.28, it says, person may operate a Class 1 ATV in the ditch or outside bank of the slope. And then it says, unless prohibited under paragraph D, which is the real clause here. If you look at paragraph D on page 3.3, it says a road authority, as defined in statute, may, after a public hearing, restrict the use of all-terrain vehicles in the public road right-of-way under its jurisdiction. What we've done here in this section is allow a road authority to restrict the use of Class 1s or Class 2 ATVs by holding a public meeting. You'll see That's further down in that section. They don't have to pass an ordinance. They just need to hold a public meeting, as they do right now under current law for Class 1s. Now this law will apply to Class 2 ATVs as well.
And Mr. Chairman, the amendment that I offered and we adopted on line 32 strikes the word trunk. So they would, these would not be allowed to be ridden on the state system. And that was after some discussions I had with the Department of Transportation, who had a lot of concern about this.
So, Mr. Chair, on that section right now, a person may ride a Class 2 ATV on a public road right-of-way. What we're trying to do with this language is say, person may operate a Class 2 ATV well within the public road right-of-way of a county state aid. Well, it used to say trunk, but now we've stricken that. So right-of-way of a county state aid or county highway on the extreme right-hand side of the road, and left turns may be made from any part of the road if it is safe to do so under prevailing conditions, unless prohibited under paragraph D. So just as we have, and then it goes on to say on page 3, a person may operate a Class 2 ATV on the ditch, on the bank or ditch of a public road right-of-way on a designated Class 2 vehicle trail. So just as our trail systems are made up of these parts of the road right-of-way in other areas of the state, we want to make sure that they're allowed to be in these areas when it's part of a designated trail. But what we've done is given the counties a tool now to come in, as has been existing for Class 1 ATVs and has been working very well, come in and hold a public meeting and say we are not going to allow the use of these machines on our public road right-of-ways.
And Mr. Chairman, one other change I'd like to note, that there is an exception on the new Clause G. There's an exception for agricultural purposes. If a farmer is using these in a farming operation, they can continue to do so.
Okay.
It's, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, it's page 3, the section starting on line 22, going 22 through 26.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Can you elaborate? Because I was trying to reconcile what you were doing over here of prohibiting the use unless, and then you've deleted in Clause C on line 232 the word trunk, but trunk continues to appear in several prohibition expressions over here, G, H, and I. And I was trying to understand what the difference is here.
The G, Ms. Chairman, Senator Olson, G is the ag exception.
So, Mr. Chairman, that ag exception is for trunk as well, then?
Yes. Yes.
And what about H? Is it's trunk there? And I?
These are for class. H is for class 1.
Yes.
That's the hours. Okay, limiting
class
hours. So, even.
Be in there.
So, only in ag use, yeah. Still, if you're
yeah,
still
exactly.
authorized to use it in ag use, you still have to have the limitation of the hours. And the date? It's
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, G, as Senator Fredrickson said, is the ag exemption. H, we're just renumbering that section, really. This is a current law where it pertains to Class 1 ATVs within the public road right-of-way in the agricultural zone from April 1st to August 1st. Well, unless the vehicle is being used exclusively as transportation to and from work on agricultural land, so it prohibits them to be there unless they're being used for ag exemptions. G, H, and I kind of work together.
Aren't you removing the class 2 ability to use a class 2 on a public road for ag purposes on page 3, line 23?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, the amendment took care
yeah.
of that.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, okay. All right. All right.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chair,
this is just kind of to flag an issue. There's two, what I personally believe are two legitimate points of view on the operation of ATVs on the roads. I mean, notwithstanding the ag stuff, but counties are increasingly allowing ATVs to be operated on their county roads, and there's controversy in localities about this. And on the one hand, people are against having ATVs on the road. It's maybe a safety problem, might be some noise issues, some of those objections. On the other hand, it's getting ATVs out of the ditches where they're kind of rutting kind of natural areas. And so if they're on the roads, they're not doing that damage anymore, which may be a positive thing. So there's two conflicting points of view there. We're not dealing with that in this bill directly, but just FYI, that might someday that's going to come up here. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point of clarification now. You're saying the local units of government, the government authorities can actually have a meeting, call a meeting. That would include townships as well and eliminate use on the roadways.
Mr. Chair, members.
Simple as that.
Currently, for Class 1 ATVs, the counties have the ability. I shouldn't say counties. Correct. It's a public road authority has the ability to hold a public meeting and restrict the use of ATVs. Anoka County and Washington County have done just that. They've held a public meeting and restricted their use statewide or countywide. What we're trying to do is expand that authority to the Class 2 ATVs as well. That was the gist of what was missed, I believe, and maybe Mr. Knopf can help me, in the bill that passed last year, was the counties did not have any authority to restrict their use. They were just placed on the road surfaces without that link. So that's what the bill does, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, members, that's on page 3, lines 3 through 5, 3, 4, and 5. That's the existing language for Class 1s. It would now also apply to Class 2.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I understand the issue, from the county's perspective, they feel like that's kind of the opt-out approach, and they would prefer the opt-in approach. They think that it's that all these vehicles are inappropriate for the roads. They don't have the proper safety equipment. They don't go appropriate speeds, et cetera. And so rather than putting the onus on the county to opt those particular vehicles out, which creates more political trouble, I think they probably rather see that they're presumed to be barred from the county roads, and then if there's some compelling reason to allow them on the county roads, have a hearing, allow them on.
That is current law, and we're not changing that here. It is current law that they can opt in. They can choose to allow ATVs on the road, county roads, if they like to. It's not required now. It does take an act of the county to allow them onto their own roads.
Mr. Chairman, it's the other way around. They can opt out.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, they're allowed on the county roads unless they hold a public meeting and say you cannot drive them on the county roads.
Only
that's
right
what
hand,
page
right
3, lines
side.
3,
this,
4,
this,
and 5
is. Different between the surface and the right-hand side.
And Mr. Chairman, the counties have talked with me, too, about this. And as Senator Dibble correctly described it, there are some counties would like to just have the state law say that. But if you get out in my district where there are a lot of county roads, some of them not heavily traveled, I think it's perfectly safe for them to operate. And I think the county boards and the respective counties should make that decision. I think it should be a local control issue.
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to point out, you're kind of both right. It depends if you're talking about the road surface or the right-hand side of the shoulder. Under current law, they're able to ride on the right-hand side of the shoulder, and the county doesn't have the authority to restrict them from the right-hand side of the shoulder, but they are not allowed on the road surface unless the county goes through and either says that the ditch is impassable, so we're going to allow them on the road surface, or if it's part of a corridor trail system, is the only way that a county can allow them on the actual surface of the road. What this would do now is say that they're still not allowed on the surface of the road, the road surface, unless you go through those two processes I mentioned earlier, that the ditch is impassable or that it's a corridor trail. But what this would say, though, is that they'll continue on a county road to be allowed on the right-hand side of the shoulder unless the county goes through a process and holds a public meeting and prohibits them from the right-hand side of the shoulder. I just wanted to clarify because there are two different processes. One is the surface of the actual road itself, and one is the right-hand side of the shoulder.
Mr. Chairman, there is a repealer in this bill also that deals with the operation of Class 2 vehicles. Exception is no longer needed. Mr. Chairman, there is one other issue, and I have an amendment to that issue, and that deals with having an open bottle of alcoholic beverages on these Class 2, being they're allowed on the highway. And I've had several people express concern about that, and I have the A3 amendment I'd like to have distributed. I would offer that amendment.
Okay, the A3 is being passed out.
And this would make it illegal to have an alcoholic beverage on the Class 2. All off-road vehicles, except when they're being operated part of a roadway that is part of a grant and aid trail or a trail designated by the Department of Natural Resources.
So what you're saying here is that you may not have an alcoholic beverage if you're on the road, basically, or a trail?
Mr. Chairman, it would be allowed on a trail, and it could be allowed on the road right-of-way if that part of the road right-of-way is part of a grant and aid trail or a trail designated by the Department of Natural Resources.
Okay. All right. Senator Parasol.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry, Senator Fredrickson, I might have missed if you mentioned whether it was open or not open.
Yep.
Bottle?
Open bottle.
Open. Oh, all right.
That's okay.
Yes, I missed that.
Senator Fredrickson, did you have your hand up?
Well, I just was concerned about the open.
Okay. Senator Dibble?
Mr. Chair, I'm not fully grasping this. So when does this prohibition kick in? I don't understand when it wouldn't under these exceptions.
Mr. Chair,
Meyer.
Members, currently, when the open bottle law was recodified several years ago, the recreation vehicle exemption, if you want to call it, was not changed. Currently, it's legal to have an open bottle on a boat, to have maybe some peppermint schnapps in the back of your snowmobile if you want to stop for a trail, and on your ATV, maybe have a beer or a wine cooler if you're going to stop and have lunch or something like that. The loophole that was created, or what we're trying to tighten down on, is when an off-road vehicle is used on a road surface. There was some concern expressed to other people, Senator Fredrickson, ourselves, and others, about the ability of these Class 2 ATVs, if they are going to be used on a road surface, that the open bottle law does not apply. It's a technical issue. The open bottle law does not apply, but still 0.08 and everything else DWI-related applies to all of those vehicles and boats. So it's just allowing that open bottle. This prohibits the open bottle on a road surface unless it's part of a designated trail system. Trying to address the issues that the sheriffs had and other people had, while allowing what I consider to be the legislative thoughts on recreational vehicles. So the intent of the legislature, in the DNR's opinion, is that they allow those uses to take place. This is a little different because now we're talking on the road surface, so we understand the need to restrict these when they are on the road surface, unless it's part of a trail system.
We're allowing, we're expanding the potential use of ATVs on roads. And we're just saying on this, the amendment is saying that if you're on the road, the open bottle law prohibition applies. But if you're on that road just because you're kind of coming out of the woods, skipping over a little while as part of a designated trail and going back into the woods, then that open bottle law would not apply.
So, Mr. Chair, if you commute to work on your ATV, don't bring a little nip on the way to work.
To put it simply.
Yeah. Or if you're just crossing the line.
Right.
If this would apply if you're just crossing a road.
This would apply if you're just crossing a road.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If that road is not part of a
trail system.
All right. Okay. Everyone understand the A3? Now, do we have to go through judiciary now on this?
Sure.
Okay. So it would have to go to the Judiciary/Crime Committee?
Mr. Chairman, I
combined.
Yeah, they're combined. Yeah.
Senator Fredrickson?
Mr. Chairman, I expect this bill needs to go to Transportation Committee, too, since we're dealing with roads, highways.
Okay. Everyone understand the A3? The amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Further discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if there's anybody wants here that wants to testify for or against the bill.
Does anyone want to comment? Mr. Bone?
Mr. Chairman, Ray Bone from the All-Terrain Vehicle Association, and we support the bill.
Senator Fredrickson.
Could you have made it shorter, Mr. Chairman? Could you have made it shorter? It's long testimony.
Senator Fredrickson, excuse me, Vickerman, do you need to see the ag changes in your committee?
It's good.
It's pretty small, but it's up to you.
Well, Mr. Chair, we're running out of time here pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
So I like the bill the way it is. So I don't want to see it unless somebody does something on the floor or does something different. Otherwise, no.
All right. I think it's got to hit two committees after this anyway.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 739 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Transportation.
Okay. Further discussion on Senate File 739. Seeing none, on the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator.
Chairman, members, thank you.
Thank you. Why don't we, Senator Starks here?
Fine.
It's pretty hot.
Senator Sparks, when we convened the meeting, I informed the audience that on your bill and the Olson bill that we're going to have time for a half an hour for total testimony, proponents and opponents. So you manage your 15 minutes whichever way you like, and the opponents will be held to the same time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll certainly stick to that. I know it's a busy time, and I did come in late. I was over in the bonding committee. But thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to testify on Senate File 311 today. It's a very important bill for our local area. I think if you look at it, currently there are 34 racetracks in Minnesota, 12 of which are privately owned and 22 of which are publicly located on county fairgrounds. 31 of those tracks, Mr. Chair and members, are currently exempt from noise standards under Minnesota statutes. This bill retains local control over the operations of racetracks, including noise, which has worked effectively at the local level in maintaining control over racetracks for many years. Mr. Chair, before we do get going, I do have an oral amendment, author's amendment, that would put the bill in the shape the author would like. That would be on page 1, line 20, strike section 561.01 and the word and, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so motor vehicle race events exempt from standards under this subdivision are exempt from claims based on noise brought under chapters 116B and 116D is how it would read after the amendment.
That is correct,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
This is the first presentation of the bill, so this is an author's amendment. So all those, Senator Olson, would you like to move that?
No, I'm just quotes.
Okay. Well, Senator Olson moves the...
You're asking if I...
Yeah.
Oh, offered. Certainly.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it. Moves that oral amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Remember, that's trying to work for some kind of a compromise with me today, and obviously I want to be very mindful of the committee's time as Mr. Randy Queensland, the owner of Deer Creek Speedway in the area that I represent in Moore County, and also Mr. Brandenhoff, who represents the racetrack. So I'll turn it over to them at this time.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Randy Queensland. My family and myself own and operate Deer Creek Speedway. This is located approximately 15 miles south of Rochester, Minnesota, in a rural country setting. Due to the time restraints, I'll move through my booklet rather quickly for you. As you can see, the front cover is actually our facility. It's got a campground with it, and an antique tractor association has a 40-acre parcel adjacent to it. There's approximately 15 homes within a half-mile radius of our facility. We're one of the most isolated racetracks in the state of Minnesota. Moving on to the second page, you can see one of the sanctioning bodies in the state of Minnesota is called WSSOTA. The racing associations are also working and sensitive to the noise issues. We're working with WSSOTA, which is over half of the racing probably that takes place in the state, to quiet cars a little bit, and we're also working with the other ones to work on it. But we don't feel this can do it alone. We need the help from this bill to bring it together. On the right side of that page, we have a very good relationship with our county commissioners. We work very close with all the county officials to be a good neighbor. There's nine items we've done in 06 to be a good neighbor. We also did this in 05. We plan on doing it in 07. You can note number 8 was a wall we put up, just again to try to alleviate some of the noise. It has not been tested to see if it's done some good. We know it's not a total sound wall. We feel it will have some bearing. One thing we do is we always follow up on any complaint we've ever had at the facility to be a good neighbor. You can see our start-stop times. We monitor those and share them with the county. We're very sensitive to be a good neighbor, and we feel our facility is in line and has as good a plan as probably any track in the state in regards of being a good neighbor. Page 3, I'm going to skip over that page for now. Mr. Brandon Hoff will talk about the different tracks within the state. Page 4 is economic impact study. I share with you the numbers on there, the impact these racetracks do have on the state of Minnesota and in the country for that matter. This is the grassroots of the most popular family sport in the state of in the country right now. The example of the 6 different racetracks, it's just to give you a little idea of our facility, which is having problems now with neighbors and noise versus the populated areas of a lot of tracks in the state. This is an example of 6 different other tracks in the state of Minnesota and the density of individual homes around them. When you go back to the front cover, we have 15 residents within a half mile, and we're having problems. You can see these areas and the concerns that these tracks are facing. The following pages gives you a little idea of different decimal levels and different sounds, just an example. Also, you can see their Deer Creek Speedway has worked closely with the Moore County Commissioners, Minnesota PCA, Minnesota DNR to implement sound practices regarding waste oil management, waste tire management programs, as well as rainwater runoff and watershed projects. All programs were recommended and approved by those organizations. Yes, we have. They've been requested to come to our facility by our neighbors. They have came. We have met. We have on file with them a used tire management plan, a waste oil management plan, and they're very accepted to them with what we're doing. We have never been cited for problems regarding those items, and we feel we're, again, probably exceeding what most tracks in the state are currently doing. The final two pages, we'll talk a little bit about the decimal levels. We are a Class 3. A neighborhood residence is a Class 1, if you look at the red lines on those charts. The bar graph shows you the time of day and the decimal level by the Moore County. It took some time readings in 04 and 05. To put it in perspective of what we can produce and what we're allowed to produce in a residence, then there's what they call the L50, which is 30 minutes in an hour, and the L10, which is 10% of an hour, 6 minutes in an hour. That is on the following page. So you can put in perspective the actual noise level and what our decimal readings are. The opposition may say we're extremely high right in their house, and if you look at the charts and then go back and relate it to what similar things are on the previous page, you can put things in perspective. Yes, race cars do make noise. This will tell you and hopefully point out to you the levels they are and show you why we're here today trying to get this bill passed. Also, in item 3, it notes, if you break down, not all of our classes exceed the noise levels. Several of them we found do not. Some of them do. And by taking the average length of a race in an evening and coming up with the cars that do not violate the noise level and those that do, it comes down to just over a little bit, over an hour a day, an hour a race. and there's approximately 25 races a year. So in a year's time, we're talking approximately 25, 26 hours of an entire year, when you put that in perspective.
Are those races, 25 races, concentrated during a particular season?
That's a typical season. Could start in April and run to the first week of October. That's what they would do. Typical race is about 4 hours. With the time that they're not racing and with the classes that do not make the excessive noise, it limits it down to less than an hour that you see in these graphs may be violated into that level.
So almost every weekend during the summer?
Any event it could be. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, help me understand the decibel level. You're talking about a 60 to 65 decibel level. Is that up above or in is that reading of 60 at the track or somewhere else?
That is in the resident's yard.
So you're reading that in the resident's yard. So the decibel level is no higher than conversational speech?
That's what we have to try to maintain, and it's, yes.
What you have to try to maintain, or what is actually happening?
We have been citations for being above normal conversation level in their residence yard, yes. That's our problem.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pearson.
Chairman, I'm not sure if I recall, did Mr. Queensland, sir, did you tell us how close you are to the residents? I mean, how far are they from your operation?
Mr. Chairman, ma'am,
Mr. Queensland.
Right now, the primary residence where these were taken is approximately 1,500 feet, a little over a quarter of a mile away from our facility.
Quarter of a mile, thank you.
Okay, Senator Dibble. Let me make sure that Senator Sparks has opportunity to complete his testimony.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Gerald Brandenhoff, attorney for Deer Creek Speedway. There are two parts to this bill. The first part changes the date exempting racetracks from the noise standards. As Senator Sparks said, there are 34 racetracks in Minnesota. 31 of them are currently exempt under 116.07 subdivision 2A. Three are not. Fergus Falls Raceway, I-94 Speedway in Sauk Center, and Deer Creek Speedway. There was a rationale for the legislature to exempt racetracks before. That same rationale exists today. There's no rational reason to treat these three racetracks differently than the others. So that's why the bill wants to move the date up to July 1 of 1996 to make these three tracks exempt from the MPCA noise standards also. With respect to the exemption from civil lawsuits, the amendment offered by Senator Sparks, removing Section 56101 from the bill, in effect preserves the right to citizens to pursue a nuisance lawsuit if they desire. It's 56101 is our general nuisance statute. It preserves that provision for citizens if they have a problem. There is a need to decouple 116B and 116D from this because the exemption under 116.07 subdivision 2A has no meaning if you're exempt from the noise standards under 116.07 subdivision 2A but subject to civil lawsuits. It's just who's going to be your plaintiff, the county or a private citizen. The exemption is basically meaningless and rings hollow unless we also have an exemption from suit under 116B and D. The reason why is 116B ties right into the noise standards set forth by the MPCA. That's the reference. Racetracks have believed for years that they would be protected if they abided by local zoning and ordinances, and this has worked for years in Minnesota. We have racetracks all over the state that are functioning and are not having these problems. The reason why the problem has arisen is there was a recent Court of Appeals case in 2001 involving a gun club, which is also exempt under this statute, which in effect said that under 116B, even if you're exempt under the noise standards, you're still subject to civil lawsuits. In effect, this bill is an attempt to change that result of that court case. Otherwise, racetracks are just vulnerable to lawsuits because it's very, very difficult to have to defend these types of lawsuits when you're supposedly exempt under the noise standards. And making exemptions is not unusual. The legislature has the authority and does it frequently, and there are numerous provisions in the statute I could cite, but I'll pick one. You can take a look at Minnesota Statute Sections 86A.23, which is the Lake Superior Safe Harbors Program, which has a provision that says expressly, the users shall have no cause of action against owners of land adjacent to small craft harbors and mooring facilities for damages resulting from noise generated by iron-producing industries. What was granted there was an exemption to iron-producing industries so marinas could be built on the North Shore, and then people couldn't complain about the noise and the dust. So what we're asking for is not necessarily unusual. As Mr. Queensland has pointed out, because Deer Creek Speedway is not currently exempt from the noise standards, it's been issued 7 criminal citations by Maurer County for exceeding the noise standards. Mr. Queensland himself has been issued 7 criminal citations individually for violating the noise standards. And the neighbors have commenced a civil lawsuit against the track under the provisions of 56101 and 116B because they're saying the track violates their rights. Admittedly, racetracks generate noise, but the racetrack is not constant or continuous. It's not steady state noise. The noise impacts are minimal. They fluctuate during an evening. And as Mr. Queensland pointed out, when you look at the big picture, 99% to 99.5% of the time, racetracks do not either generate any noise or they're below the noise standards.
Mr. Knopf, on the 116B portion, did you have any thoughts on that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's the Environmental Rights Act. I just was mentioning to you earlier, I wasn't sure if this bill was headed to judiciary or not, and I wasn't sure if taking away the rights of individuals to sue under that act would require this to go to the Judiciary Committee.
116B is Environmental Rights
Act. That's an individual lawsuit. And 116D is the Environmental Policy Act, which would, environmental review is conducted under 116D.
And that's PCA?
It's the Environmental Quality Board.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I would agree with counsel. I do believe that this bill would have to go to judiciary for those exact reasons.
Why do you need to do more than just change the date?
Changing the date will, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, changing the date will bring the three tracks into the exemption from the MPCA noise standards, but it'll still, under that court case, leave all 34 racetracks in Minnesota subject to civil lawsuits for violating noise standards they supposedly are exempt from.
Well, how?
Because anybody can sue and they can allege you're violating the noise standards, and the other statute, 116.07.2A, says you're exempt from those noise standards. Deer Creek is not currently exempt, but every other racetrack in Minnesota, except for those three, are exempt. It puts them in a bind. I mean, on the one hand, they're exempt from the noise standards, and on the other hand, they can be sued civilly for violating the noise standards.
But if you're exempt, how can you be sued civilly?
Because the court case said, under 116B, just because you're exempt under the MPCA noise standards does not make you exempt from civil suits under 116B.
Okay. All right. So the 1996, the move from the insertion of 1996 brings three additional racetracks into the exemption, but the rest of the language applies to all the racetracks in the state of Minnesota.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
This is kind of a bit more than just Deer Creek, then.
This was never intended to be strictly a Deer Creek bill. It just happens, Mr. Chair, that this was the impetus for having to do this. This is supported by most of the racetracks in Minnesota.
Okay, Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. My inquiry was along the lines that you started. You know, that may well be the purpose of our courts. I mean, I think it's important that we strike a balance here. And, you know, I think to go forward with this language exempting these racetracks from suit means that they can emit noise beyond all reason. I mean, I think you know, the core of the goal of the bill is to try to create, you know, some of that balance, you know, that we have to strike with these racetracks, which clearly have some impact on people's ability to enjoy their property, you know, adjacent or near the racetrack, and the ability of the racetrack to continue to operate. And, you know, it's a little noisy and you know, they exist and we have to figure that out. However, to include the additional language means that, you know, all the things that the testifiers are saying about, well, you know, we're noisy, but we're not that noisy. We're reasonably noisy, and we operate within certain parameters. You know, all of that is just lifted, and there's no ability to strike that balance, you know, and eliminate some of that pressure that's available to us through a court process. I think perhaps changing the dates might be appropriate, but to include all that other language seems to be a pretty strong measure to take.
Mr. Brandinoff, why don't you take Senator Anderson, then Mr. Brandinoff, then we have to move to the other witnesses. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did I hear you say that there's a pending lawsuit now that's been brought by neighbors and also civil prosecutions?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, that's correct. There are criminal citations against the track and Mr. Queensland individually for violating the noise standards because his track's not exempt. And there's a civil lawsuit by the neighbors against the racetrack based upon noise, neither of which currently will be affected by this bill because this bill is not going to be retroactive. So, but I hope that's responsive to your question, Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble. This bill is in effect, although it may not seem like it, is in effect to balance the interests of private citizens and the racetracks. We removed 561.01, which is the general nuisance statute. They still have a right to sue under that statute. The only reason 116B is in there asking for an exemption from that statute is that's tied directly to the noise standards of the MPCA, and to do that, in effect, renders the entire exemption meaningless.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Anderson.
I guess I wouldn't accept your, you know, the fact that if we were to pass this law during the existence of a lawsuit, it could have an impact on it. I mean, you're right, it's not retroactive, but it certainly could affect the outcome of the lawsuit. So I think that's something that needs to be considered. Okay. The legislature tries to avoid getting into that other branch of government and trying to sort of predetermine the outcome.
All right. We'll move on to Ms. Gettleman, Mr. Hyland, and Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the record, we obviously want to make sure that they have their time to speak. County Commissioner Ray Tucker was not able to be here today out of conflict, but he did say that he is in support of this legislation, so I wanted to commit.
He's on Mauer County Commissioner.
Mauer County Commissioner, that's
thank
right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair
you.
And members of the committee.
Yeah, I got him.
Thank you, Mr. Queensland.
Thank you.
You might need another chair up there.
You do need another chair.
Here, you can have one here. Sit here. You can have one here. Sit here.
All right, who'd like to go first?
I'll go first.
All right.
My name is Debbie Gettleman. I actually live about, I'm the resident actually that's about 1,500 feet, or whatever it is, from Deer Creek Speedway. If you look at his map, look under the M, my house is right there. I honestly cannot live in my home when there's a race. And if they try to tell you it's maybe an hour a night, they're wrong. If you want to know the truth, the water in my toilet will vibrate at times when there's race cars going around the track. We have a handheld monitor, which we have checked with the states, and it is only about 1 decibel difference, give or take a little. I am getting 85 80 to 85 decibels any night there's a race in my backyard. This means I cannot have a conversation in my backyard. I cannot have family and friends there. I can't watch TV. We have to leave every night there's a race. Now, do you want to send it to the local government? Well, the county commissioners, we have talked to them separately. We have gone in groups. We have gone to their meetings. We have sent them letters. We have called them. They will do nothing. They have told us this is a business. They can do whatever they want. So they look at us when we come to a county commissioner's meeting and start laughing. And that is no joke. Randy Queensland actually knew the problems of this racetrack long before he bought it. This is a small area. He lives in Grand Meadow, 5 miles away, Spring Valley, 6 miles away. And he knew a long time ago, before he bought this racetrack, that we were having problems, we were asking for noise things, and we just finally got the county to come in and monitor it in the 2005, and that's when the lawsuits came in. And yes, I am part of the civil lawsuit. And the reason I know Randy knows about this is because his son is married to my niece. So it is not, definitely has not been something that he did not know about. So go ahead.
Okay. Good morning, Senator. Please introduce yourself.
Yep. Good morning, Senators. My name is Rick Hyland. I am also a neighbor. I live 3/4 of a mile away from the track. And I have also borrowed the monitor and some peaks. Just to give you an idea, at 3/4 of a mile away, the peak decibels have been as much as 88 decibels, and that's far over the standard. The racetrack has also been heard quite often as far as 20 miles away from the site of the track. And the one important thing you must remember is the law was put into place in 1983. These racetracks that have been built after that knew what the law was. They knew what the decibel limits were. And they have chosen now to try to change the law. And after if you change the law to 1996, there's going to be more racetracks built, and within 2 years they'll be here doing the same thing, to be exempt from the one you've done today or might do today. In the year of 2000, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency stated in the Pioneer Press of June 24th that this track was in compliance. And if you check with the sheriff's reports on the nuisance noise complaints, you'll see that that was probably true. They dropped right down to nothing. So this track can be in compliance with the law that's on the books now, but they choose not to. As far as the track owners addressing all the problems, you know, and complaints, I mean, most of the neighbors will tell you could come down there and ask them. You know, we've not ever been really confronted personally with anybody, except through the county commissioners, which to no avail, and that's why the lawsuit came. Everything kind of went wrong with this track. You know, it was built really with not the right kind of permits. There was never a public meeting at the county level on this track. There was never an environmental impact study done, or even an application for an environmental impact study. So if you guys exempt this track today from these standards that the state has got, that's the only thing that is holding them partway in check now. If this gets exempted, there will be nothing to hold them in check at all.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. You said you had 80% on one reading, you said?
I had 88 decibels.
Okay, was that?
That was a peak level. And that was on a handheld monitor that had been, how would you say it? It was 1 decibel off of what the state has. Actually, it was a 0.01 off of the one that the county has.
My question is, I don't know how long the races go, 3-4 hours a night, something like that. Was that
they average. They've raced, that was in 2004, until 2:30 in the morning on a Thursday night.
Was that one reading or was that the average reading is where I'm going?
That was a peak reading at my place, and that's 3/4 of a mile away. That was a peak reading.
All right.
And that was just one given night.
What was the lowest reading in that?
Lowest reading when everything is quiet is usually about 55. And decibels, you know, double at every 10 decibels.
I've gotten up to 92 decibels.
Mr. Anderson?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senators, my name is Richard Anderson. I'm from Eden Prairie, but I have property in Spring Valley, which is, in Fillmore County, which is directly adjacent to the track. We've been talking about decibels, and we have one of the experts here with Brian Timerson with the MPCA. I would like to call him, Brian, if you would, to explain where, 65 to 95 or 100 doesn't sound like a lot, but if he could explain, if for your understanding, why it is so loud at 95 decibels.
Well, first of all, we'd like to hear your testimony.
I apologize. I handed out a little sheet. These are just questions that are glaring for me. And just to read through them, why does a race car need to break Minnesota noise pollution standards of 65 decibels by producing 95 decibels? Is it a noise track or is it a racetrack? I mean, why is the noise that important to the race? That's one of my glaring questions. If you're watching a NASCAR on TV, do you turn your TV up to 95 decibels? No. If you were hearing 95 decibels in this room or 85 decibels, you would have to leave. You would not be able to hear any conversation whatsoever.
I guess I've never been to a NASCAR race, but wouldn't if you were at the NASCAR race, wouldn't you be hearing?
Well, no, he meant if you were watching it on your television.
I heard that. But if you were at the NASCAR race, wouldn't you be receiving 95 decibels? Isn't that kind of the nature of a car race?
It probably is the nature of a race, but is it the nature of the people that are next to the racetrack to listen to it? I mean, it's every Saturday night. A good friend of ours' daughter was going to Iraq. She's in Iraq right now. Could not have a party at their house on Saturday night because of the noise. Every Saturday night. It's in the most beautiful times. This is why we live in Minnesota, so we can have the summers. You can't have it. With this thing going on every Saturday night, you can't have it. Why are these cars? And another question, they talk about the 34 other tracks here, sir. Some of them are running with noise control. Not all the tracks are running at 95 decibels. A lot of them, I think the track in Owatonna, some of the other ones, in Brainerd, they're monitored. The local authorities, local government, dictates that they do follow the pollution control standards. This track was compliant. Why can't it be compliant again? We're not trying to shut the track down. We know there's an economic benefit of it. But why do we have to be subjected to listening to it? If you tried putting this track in St. Paul or Minneapolis, it would never fly. It's too loud. And once again, the violations that are outstanding against Mr. Queensland, they have not been resolved. They have raised till 2:30 in the morning. They are trying to control that now? Probably, yes, because they've gotten in trouble. They know they need to control that. Once again, mufflers and catalytic converters, soundproofing, a lot will take care of that. The state is allowing these violations to occur, and they're not doing anything about them. They need to do that. Why are the private boxes at Deer Creek Speedway soundproofed? If noise is so darn important, how come they're soundproofed? Why not open the windows up and let everybody listen to the noise? Environmental impact study. The EPA, the MPCA, World Health Organization, and OSHA all say 95 decibels is dangerous. Dangerous to hearing. It will affect your hearing. Those are the laws that are in place right now. And we are not following the law. We talked earlier about seatbelts in Class 2 ATVs. I've got an ATV. I've got a farm. We're protecting the people that are driving those ATVs, but we're not doing anything about this sound. It's atrocious. The tracks policing themselves, it hasn't worked before. It's the chicken garden hen house theory. It's not going to work again.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's the fox guarding the hen house.
That's right.
Chickens are really good at guarding their own.
I missed it. I'm not.
We understand what you meant.
Okay.
We understand what you meant.
Yeah.
And then we talked about the 25 hours. Yeah, over a period of time, it's 25 hours, but it's every Saturday night. That's the issue here. Well, like I said, nobody wants to shut this thing down. They just want it to run quietly or run quieter. Excuse me. It doesn't have to be 95 decibels at the car. That's just ridiculous. Are you going to say something else?
Oh, yeah. I was going to mention, too, Mr. Queensland has made a step in the right direction at the Wasota end. trying to make it a standard to drop the cars all down to 95 decibels, but this is also measured at 100 feet away from the car, not at the car. But the thing is, WSOTA's track record for keeping their own tracks in check is not very good. WSOTA's own, in their own by rules, it says that all tracks that are under government regulation or local government must abide by those regulations. Well, this track hasn't done that since 2001. And when it was WSOTA Racing Commission has done nothing to keep them in check. So that's why we need this state law to stay where it's at, so there is something we can fall back on, is to help protect the citizenship of the people that live around here. I mean, that's why the legislatures in 83 put this law into effect. They had the foresight to know something like this was going to happen. And I'd like to thank you. Okay.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, just for clarification, both of you lived near the racetrack before the noise got
yes.
bad? Is that
I have lived in that area for 24 years, within a mile of the racetrack.
And, Mr. Chair, sir, there was a racetrack there when you moved there?
The racetrack was started construction in 95, and the first race was in 96.
Okay.
Chairman and members, I've lived there for 34 years.
Ms. Gettleman.
And many of the people that have lived around us live there longer. There's people that have lived there 40, 45 years, and they're extremely upset because they don't have a life. And this isn't every Saturday night. If you would ever look at the races, they have special races, which is practice on Wednesday night, races Thursday, Friday, Saturday night. If they're rained out, they race on Sunday. So there's many people that, I mean, there's people that live half a mile or so away that these people get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go to work, 4:30.
It starts on the 4th of next month. That's a practice. Every Saturday night through April. Oh, it's every Saturday night until September 15th. There's one night off on September 15th on a Saturday. There are other races on Fridays and Thursdays. But then after the September 15th race, then there's a four-day extravaganza from Thursday through Sunday.
And, Mr. Chair?
Senator Anderson?
And did you, I believe I heard, I just want to be clear that you are testifying that you were able to coexist with this racetrack at one point in time when it was operating and holding races?
When the racetrack started, it was a more or less a little local dirt track. They had maybe 12 races a year or a season. And, well, the racetrack has evolved. You know, racing is a great sport. A lot of people like it. And it has evolved, and Randy has done a lot to make it evolve. He's a very good businessman. But the problem is, he wasn't that nice to the neighbors about it. Well, I can't say that either, but, I mean, he more or less didn't really concern himself with the neighbors. He's also stated that to the Pioneer Press. He didn't put it that way, but the noise issue was not a concern of his.
Senator Dibble. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, those are the kind of arguments that I'm familiar with. You know, Senator Pariseau and I just had this brief little sidebar. You know, who was there first, and if you knew it was there, why did you move there? And the airport, of course, gets brought up. What that ignores is two things. One is, you know, a lot of folks bought their homes near the airport quite a while ago when it was just kind of a little dirt airport. and it also ignores the reality of deregulation and the number of flights that have increased. And there's one is volume is one thing, but duration is another form of intensity. You know, the persistency of the noise has another quality of life impact.
We got to kind of move on here. Did the PCA want to comment on this?
Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, could I ask?
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Scogin, you did have your hand up earlier.
Thank you. Mr. Anderson, you said you had land adjacent to the track.
I do not have land adjacent to the track. The reason I became involved in this was I do have property in Fillmore County. But one of the reasons that I became involved in this was I camp down there. I hunt down there. I deer hunt right downstream. And I know that there was some talk of everything had been at the plans and everything looks okay on paper. And I can't prove that it came from there, but you can't prove it didn't. When I downstream down Deer Creek Speedway or downstream from Deer Creek Speedway after the September 2004 flood, there was a lot of 5-gallon containers of used oil. There was oil filters. There are still saucers that are used for putting underneath the car and dropping the oil. I can still show you one. I can take you right down where I deer hunt and show you one. Now, the plans may be in place, but whether they are implemented, I can't say for sure. And that is what got my blood boiling. I don't have to listen to this. I'm kind of pulled into this. And like I said, I can't prove at that time it was reported, but it was never brought up. But the pit was seen underwater. The pit is in the floodplain right now. And it was seen underwater with used combines from a combine demolition derby. There was all kinds of things in the pit. And my question is, where'd they go? That's what brought me into this.
Are you involved in the lawsuit?
Yes, sir, I am.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Stephen.
Sorry, I apologize I came in late. I was in capital investment. But I have a question for Senator Sparks. So this legislation, it's not only exempting them from the noise standards, but it's also exempting people who feel that they would have a possibility of making a claim that we're exempting the racetrack owners from any future claims?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben, I don't believe that's true. We're looking for a compromise, and we would allow those lawsuits to continue to go forward.
Under Section 56101. There was an oral amendment, Senator Sieben.
Okay,
PCA.
Mr. Chair, Committee, my name is Brian Timerson. I'm with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I don't know if there were any questions relating to decibels and relationship to observed noise levels.
Is this track out of the norm from other tracks around the state?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the agency was quite involved with this track. When we did some monitoring, we worked with the previous owners, got the facility into compliance with the state noise rules. Then through some ownership changes, we decided to work with the county. We loaned the county noise monitoring equipment to do the assessment and testing, but we have deferred enforcement with the county because Maurer County is monitoring and dealing with the situation now. But as far as I'm understanding, we don't do a lot of monitoring for a lot of these racetracks because many of them are exempt from the Pollution Control Agency noise rules under this statute.
Okay, committee, what would you like to do?
Mr. Chair, may I just kind of wrap up? I know time is getting kind of short. I appreciate the opportunity. I would just like to respond to a few of the questions. The property that we are talking about was zoned for this very use since the late 60s, so I think that needs to be made a point. Also, I would refer members back to the map. It's not just about a Deer Creek Speedway. I think that I represent Lansing Speedway that was grandfathered in and has many more people around. If you look around the entire state, there's a lot of racetracks that could be affected by this legislation. Alexandria, Wilmer, Casson, Slayton, Montevideo. So obviously we'll leave up to the committees.
Mr. Knopf, what is 56101? What's the difference between 56101 and 116B? What are the different rights for those two?
Well, Mr. Chairman, 56101 is any nuisance. Basically, that allows a person to bring lawsuits for basically a nuisance. 116B is specifically the Environmental Rights Act, and that's for people who are violating basically air, water, or other natural resources, violating. In fact, there's a prima facie evidence if you're violating a permit or rule. Under current law, since they're not exempted from the noise standard, somebody could bring a lawsuit under 116B specifically for violating the noise standard. But if they're exempt from the noise standard, there would have to be further proof that they're somehow violating their rights to a healthy environment.
Okay. Senator Dibble.
Well, Mr. Chair, this particular bill is drafted to Chapter 116, and it's a pretty black and white exemption that's given to these facilities, from the noise standards. And so, to be able to take people's rights to you know, to bring a lawsuit forward away completely, just to ask the courts to say these facilities are fully exempted, but, you know, we'd like at least some standard of reasonableness under, you know, the very chapter that this particular exemption is written to, I think, is a little bit of an overstep. So I'd like to...
Mr. Chair, may I respond to that? And maybe counsel can help me. I don't think that's our intent at all. We're still allowing people to bring forth actions.
Under a different chapter of the law, Mr. Chair, not to the standards that might be called out in Chapter 116.
Yeah, Senator Sparks, you can still, even though a gun club, for example, is exempt from the noise standards, someone can still sue the gun club under 116B or 116D or 56101. And what you're saying is that there are two chapters under which you could not sue a racetrack.
Mr. Chair, I believe that's right. I'm not an attorney, so I'd probably have to ask for a little help on that. But I believe that is the intent.
Yeah. Well, that's what your bill says.
Right.
So, Senator Dibble.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I can clarify that, I think that's a fairly correct assessment.
Mr. Brennanoff.
Yes. That's a fairly correct assessment. Our compromise was to remove 56101 from the bill to let citizens sue racetracks for nuisance. The reason for taking 116B or leaving 116B in to create an exception for lawsuits for noise was to make it consistent with the exemption that's granted under the MPCA noise standards. Otherwise, you're granted an exemption under the noise standards under 116072A, and then you're vulnerable to suit over here for violating the same noise standards that this statute said you were exempt from. That's the only thing they're trying to do. Leave it up to the citizens if they want to sue. The other thing that's missing here is that 116072A still says the local authorities control everything and they can impose whatever rules and regulations they want, including ones that are more strict than the MPCA NOR standards.
Okay. Senator Dibble, sorry to interrupt you.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's unusual for us to remove any form of accountability that someone might have under the law by taking people's rights away, you know, from pursuing a lawsuit. I mean, to say that someone is totally unaccountable to the courts or to the law by taking citizen rights away to file a lawsuit, I mean, that's a really big step to take.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble.
Hold on. We're going to leave the discussion to the committee now unless they have specific questions for the witnesses. Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, I understand the concerns about taking away the right to action, but I'm also just as concerned about exempting more tracks from noise standards. I think they're both problematic, and, you know, Senator Sparks, I know it's difficult when you've got constituents on different sides of an issue. It's really put you in a difficult position, and you're trying to help a business. But I think you said there's four tracks that would be affected by this, and we haven't even heard testimony from any of the other ones. We have no idea what impact this would have around the state if we were to make this blanket exemption from noise standards. It would go way beyond this group of neighbors. It would affect others. And we heard testimony that because of the exemption under law, the general exemption, that the authorities don't even monitor noise because they think there's a general policy by the legislature that racetracks are exempt from standards, from noise standards. And so I think we're really letting down our obligation to the citizens here. I mean, I don't know the facts in terms of whether the racetrack is really how many decibels, how high they're really going. I guess there's a dispute about that. And that's the kind of thing that could be worked out in court if we're not able to figure it out ourselves or at the local level. But I'm just really uncomfortable with the whole bill.
This reminds me of the shooting range issue.
Mr. Chair? In Alexandria, I know that the city and the county monitor their racetrack, and it's in a residential area, and people are building closer to it. And they watch the times of the race and the dates of the races, and so I think the local forms of government have a good handle on it.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Scogin, that's the theory, and I'm sure it does work in some communities, but I'm not sure. It sounds like that might not be working here, and so that I don't know, and I don't want to judge without having enough facts, but it sounds like the interests of the local residents is maybe they're not being heard by the folks who should be monitoring the noise. I don't know. I don't know. We have a dispute here, but it makes me uncomfortable to take sides and say, sorry, you're out of luck, without knowing for sure that they are their interests are being protected.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, if that's the case, they need to work with their local forms of government if there's a communication problem. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Senator Engelbretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with Senator Scogin that we didn't talk a whole lot about local units of government here, and I think they have a certain amount of responsibility to take this thing, even though I know the testifier said that it didn't work real well with their county board. Also, it's very clear here on the third page, I believe it is, that 31 of the 34 racetracks are already exempt from this noise situation. So we're talking about actually bringing these three racetracks in compliance with everybody else in the state of Minnesota. So,
Mr. Chair, I think my first or second year I was elected years ago, I brought a bill that Senator Vickerman might remember because he really helped me out, where I had neighbors who were very upset because a highway that had been built probably in the 50s and it was not a problem, became a problem, just like the airport, because traffic increased. This is an inner-city neighborhood, a wonderful neighborhood with beautiful homes, and it had gotten to the point where parents tried to call their children in the backyard, and they couldn't hear them. And, you know, I think when things get to that point, that's when people expect their government to step in and say, we're going to help you. There has to be a balance. So, you know, I think we have a responsibility to listen to those citizens. It's a legitimate business that has a legitimate right to operate, but if we can't find a way for them to operate in a way that the citizens can coexist with, then we have a problem, and there has to be a way to find that accommodation. But I don't see that taking away all the local rights of citizens will help find a balance. I mean, I'd really like to be able to... I think you need a mediator or someone to try to work this out at the local level.
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, I appreciate your comments, and we have it does obviously put a senator in a kind of a tough position. We have tried to work with this. I think if you look back, the racetrack has worked hard. I understand what Mrs. Gettleman and some of the area people talked about, but this is in really a rural area. Obviously, we don't want to take anyone's rights away, but it is an important issue. Obviously, the Judiciary Committee will really focus on this if this committee decides to act favorably, but something that's very important to the local community has a huge economic impact.
Either there's a motion or I need to lay this over.
Where do you want it to go?
Well, the way it's written now, it does have to go to Judiciary. If we approve the exemption, the Judiciary would then review the claims exemption. We're particularly looking at the noise exemption. Senator Engelbretson?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, if there's no more further discussion, I'd like to move that we...
Well, Mr. Chair, I was going to make a different motion.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Senator Dibble?
Maybe I can help Senator Sparks from traveling around too much and not going to Judiciary. I would move that we just delete that lawsuit exemption sentence in the spirit of trying to find the balance that I think Senator Sparks is looking for.
So you're talking about lines 18 through 20 after the 1996 period.
Right.
Delete lines 18, the new language in 18 through 20.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Paris.
Question on that point is that what are we going to do with all those that are now exempt? I mean, how will this start to fall? One after another, will we be here all the time because now we've changed things for one track?
Under the Dibble Amendment or the bill?
Under the Dibble Amendment.
No, the Dibble Amendment would
would bring it back from so that no one would be allowed this particular claims exemption. Under the Sparks bill as it's written, everyone would be allowed this claims exemption. Exemption from claims. All the racetracks would be. Senator Dibble and then Senator Sparks.
Mr. Chair, I think finding that balance is extremely important. And keep in mind that this is a fairly coherent, comprehensive statement of exemption from noise laws. But to remove anyone's ability to file a lawsuit to strike that right balance in the courts when it's become very difficult to work with a particular operator, whether it's an individual or the local unit of government, is an extraordinary exemption. And frankly, I disagree with the witness that said that it would make this exemption meaningless to not protect them from lawsuits. The purpose of lawsuits and the purpose of our courts is mediating, strongly held differences of opinion to find strike the appropriate balance between the right of the racetrack to operate, under the understood laws, and the rights of the neighbors or the local unit of government to exercise some reasonableness around that operation, so that if we're taking away the right of anyone to sue, we're basically saying anyone around there can just suffer the consequences to their health, to the environment, and there's no ability to moderate or mediate that effect at all, and there's no one out there who has any further say about it.
Senator Sparks, you want to comment on the amendment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, thank you for trying to help. Certainly it was never my intent to take anyone's rights away. I know that if the bill did move on, the Judiciary Committee would obviously take a good look at that. Senator Moore is very astute in those areas. But obviously I'd like to keep the bill moving, so I guess I'll leave it up to the committee to decide what they would like to do.
If we pass the amendment, I think we're just left with environment policy issues, and I will then lay this over for consideration in the omnibus policy bill if the amendment passes. Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you were leaving the 1996 date in, is all the change at both places.
Correct. That's what the Dibble amendment does.
I just have one question as to the lawsuit that was decided that said there was the right to sue based on the standards from which we've exempt. What meaning does the exemption have then? It's a strange animal that has been created with that particular case.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there probably is still room for a lawsuit, but It is essentially a court decision that eliminates a statute's power in terms of exemption. That's what I'm still a little puzzled by that one.
Council has an explanation.
Do you want Carol?
Ms. Baker.
Just explain
the difference, the impact.
No, Mr. Chair, the difference is that you have to prove your case. If you were to sue under the 116B or 116D, there's a higher level of proof. They really have to prove damages, and so it's not quite as easy as just getting, a citation from the PCA or something. It's much more powerful and much more heavy burden, and you get big lawsuits, and that's what they're trying to get away from. On the other hand, that's the right that citizens have. And I'm not sure, I haven't read that case, the 2001 Court of Appeals case, to see if, what their reasoning was, what their analysis is, because from just, a first look at it without reading it, it does seem funny. There's an exemption, but there's clearly a cause of action in another. So it is kind of a gray area.
Mr.
Chairman, Senator Olson, the only thing I'd add is also in the Environmental Rights Act, the violation of a rule or law is prima facie evidence of a rights violation. So that prima facie just means that you have to prove that it's not
basically, if you're brought under that. So it would take away the prima facie evidence in an environmental rights violation.
Senator Parasol.
So, Mr. Chairman, if the local units of government with authority in this case are not monitoring and recording decibels at different times or at any time, what would be the evidence? Anybody could say, I've got a monitor that says, and so, but if they aren't party to the suit, I don't know.
Well, they could hire.
It seemed to me that the authorities
have
to be monitored.
They could hire an independent person to come in and mm-hmm. you know, an expert to come in and gather evidence like any lawsuit. Senator Bickerman, did you have your hand up?
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to figure out
if he's quitting at 11,
how to get this place don't like to compromise. Several bills around here that people don't want to compromise. So I'm looking at maybe laying this bill on the table with the understanding that you get together and see if there is some kind of a compromise. Because regardless, if you send it out here to your judiciary, it'll stick it right back on there. Been around here a while. I know how that works. So I don't like to do that unless Senator Sparks objects. That's fine. But I have racetracks in my district. And the county commissioner is going to build a brand-new grandstand just not for a three-day fair, but it's for Friday night's racetrack. The biggest thing in Slayton and Worthington and Jackson are racetracks. They just come. And it's crazy. I mean, the families, it's a family organization even that comes out. And so I'm trying to figure out how we can keep that going. I know there's probably some noise there, but I'll tell you one thing. If you want to hear noise, you come and spend the night at my place and my son's running that corn dryer for 30 days straight right by my house.
You're not going to build a house right next to it?
But I look at it this way. When it's running, he's making money.
It's water torture.
So I'm just trying to figure out some way. You know, if we're going to run out of time, I don't want to do that. But Senator Sparks, what would you – can you think if we have some time, you could work
Mr.
this out?
Mr. Chair and Senator Vickerman, I appreciate it. I think that you know me well enough that – normally, I wouldn't bring a bill in front of you unless I could find some kind of a compromise. This has been an issue that's been going on. It's a local issue that's very important. I wish we could find some more agreement, but at this point, we really can't. And so I appreciate the chair giving me a hearing, and we'd like to move forward.
Are you making that motion?
Mr. Chairman, we have a motion on the floor.
There is a motion.
Oh, he's considering a higher motion. Okay, so if you haven't done that, then we're on the...
When are we going to meet again? All week?
Tonight? Wednesday night.
We've got Wednesday, Thursday, and after spring break.
Well, Mr. Chair, then I'm going to move we lay this bill over till we have a little bit more compromise, if possible. And you can turn that down. That's fine. But I'm just trying to help two different groups here, and I feel for the people that have their homes right there, too. Maybe we can work out something. So I will make the – I'll move that we lay this – Senate file 311 on the table for further consideration.
Okay. Higher motion, no debate. All those in favor of the motion to table Senate file 311, say aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
No. Motion prevails. Senator Sparks, we'll keep talking. We haven't reached our deadlines yet, but you can still bring your bill back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Racetracks, too, they're fun. Racetracks are fun.
Did Senator Frederickson's
pass? It's just tough.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, my bill isn't as noisy as this one was, but I think there are people that would like to speak on both sides of it, and I don't think we have the time left to give that.
We don't have time to give the full testimony, but we can make sure that your citizens that have come give the opportunity to testify if you'd like.
Well, let me check with them to see if they have a problem if you would reschedule it.
We did.
Let's go.
What I suggested, members, to Senator Olson was that if the citizens would like to provide their testimony, we can certainly take enough time to do that. We still have till 11 or a little bit after, which is round about the time we had scheduled, slotted anyway for the proponents. But it's totally up to you. We can reschedule the bill if you'd like more time.
Okay. I know that there are others, including myself, that have other commitments at
11. Okay. Well, we can take the bill on another agenda. It's totally up to you.
What do you want to do? Just waiting for you to tell them.
Well,
Senator Olson,
I think we need time to do it justice.
Okay. All right.
You know, this took over an hour.
It did.
I'm not so sure that this one may take a little over a half an hour, too.
Yeah, yeah,
unless
it's true.
Unless you just want to perfunctorily.
No, I think we probably need time on your bill as well. So I apologize for the previous bill taking so long, but we'll schedule your bill on at another meeting. Okay?
Appreciate it. Thank you.
There's no further discussion. The meeting's adjourned.